Good morning, Montreal. You are tuned to the Wednesday Morning After on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. We have a stacked show for you today with one pre-recorded interview from news, arts and culture, and music. The first interview is news about apartheid. The organization known as Independent Jewish Voices is holding a Together Against Apartheid campaign over the crimes of Israel counter Palestinians. Aaron Lakoff, former news coordinator of CKUT, will be our guest. The second pre-recorded interview will be with Pemi Paul of the Warhol Dervish String Quartet. They will be playing new music from Mozart in a five-part concert series. The third pre-recorded interview will come from OSA Band's members. They are introducing their latest music. 8 o'clock brings Democracy Now!, 8:15 brings Weather, and after that we'll talk about Funding Drive this week and give you a chance to call in and make donations. You can start that now by calling 514-907-9424 and speaking with computers and staff online. 8:30 we'll visit the podcast called In the Shower with Taz and Marcus, where this week's question is, why do humans love music? After some more music, we'll wrap up the show. On February 1st, Amnesty International launched a major report concluding that Israel is practicing apartheid against Palestinians. In doing so, they've become the third large human rights organization to come to the same conclusion in just over a year. With us today, we have Aaron Lakoff of Independent Jewish Voices. Hi, Aaron, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Sheila. Thanks so much for having me on.
First, please introduce yourself and tell us how you came to be involved in Independent Jewish Voices.
As you said, my name is Aaron Lakoff. I used to be quite involved at CKUT Radio. I was the former news coordinator at CKUT. But a lot of my history of activism has been based around the situation in Israel-Palestine and standing up for Palestinian human rights. So, you know, I'm someone who's Jewish and I come from a Jewish background. And like so many Jews out there in the world, we feel an added responsibility to speak out against Israel's crimes against humanity, because oftentimes these abhorrent things that we're seeing Israel commit against Palestinians, such as the crime of apartheid or the ongoing occupation, you know, the refugee crisis, those actions happen in the name of Jewish people all over the world. And so there's been this profound movement for decades now, in fact, since Israel's inception in the 1940s, to say not in our name. And so, you know, in the early 2000s, I was involved in a group here in Montreal called the Jewish Alliance Against the Occupation. And we would do pickets outside the Israeli consulate in Montreal every Friday to try to bring attention to the Palestinian freedom struggle. I've been to Palestine on a couple occasions myself, you know, both in my role as an activist and as an independent journalist. And then I started working for Independent Jewish Voices, which is a national organization here in Canada that brings together Jews from all across the country, you know, in support, again, of Palestinian human rights and Palestinian freedom. I started working for Independent Jewish Voices as the communications and media lead in November of 2019, and I've been there since.
What is the history and purpose of Independent Jewish Voices?
So Independent Jewish Voices was founded in 2008. Prior to its founding, there was a lot of little kind of local groups of Jewish anti-apartheid activists or Jewish Palestine solidarity activists that existed across the country. So, you know, the one I just mentioned here in Montreal, the Jewish Alliance Against the Occupation. In Vancouver, there was Jews for a Just Peace. There were groups in Toronto and in other cities. And in 2008, there was this push to unite all these efforts across the country and to bring them together into kind of one, you know, singular organization. And that became Independent Jewish Voices. So it operates as a little bit of a coalition. But of course, there's lots of different local chapters in cities and on university campuses across the country. So by last count, we had 18 different chapters from as far east as Halifax and as far west as Victoria, BC.
What is the purpose of Independent Jewish Voices?
Well, I'd say that, you know, the main purpose is just to have a strong voice representing Jews in Canada who are you know, speaking out in support of Palestinian human rights and freedoms and, you know, criticizing the state of Israel for its actions when that criticism needs to be said. We were one of the first national organizations in the world to endorse the Palestinian-led boycott, divestments, and sanctions, or BDS campaign. So we started supporting and getting involved in BDS back in 2009. You know, I would say another one of our goals, or another one of our kind of raison d'être, if you will, is also to counteract what we would call the weaponization of anti-Semitism. So we know that anti-Semitism is a real problem all around the world. We know that discrimination against Jews is real. And, you know, we feel that on almost an everyday basis. But unfortunately, a lot of pro-Israel groups are taking anti-Semitism and weaponizing it to use it against those who are speaking out in favor of Palestinian human rights. One of the ways we've seen this concretized in recent years is with a definition that's being kind of adopted around the world that's called the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism. And that definition is really dangerous because essentially it says that critiques of Israel and Zionism amount to anti-Semitism. So a lot of our work has been to try to, you know, fight definitions like that, to try to educate people to have an understanding of anti-Semitism that is, let's say, divorced or separate from legitimate critiques of Israel and Zionism.
What is the definition of apartheid?
It's a good question. So a lot of people think of apartheid in reference to South Africa. You know, it was the regime that oppressed Black South Africans and South Africans of color from 1948 all the way up until the early 90s. And then, of course, it was, you know, famously brought down by people like Nelson Mandela and Bishop Desmond Tutu, and of course, a global campaign of solidarity with the South African people. But apartheid is a legal term. It's been codified in international law, and it can, in fact, apply to a number of different countries who practice systemic discrimination based on race of another racial group of people. So the way that I oftentimes think about it is any country where you would see legalized racism and legalized racial discrimination against one group of people. But like I said, apartheid has been codified in international law. So there's the Apartheid Convention from the United Nations that was drafted and ratified in the 1970s. Then more recently, the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, which came about in the late 90s. And very simply, those two pieces of international law together say that apartheid occurs where there is three elements. So one, an intent to maintain a system of domination by one racial group over another, a systemic oppression by one racial group over another, and one or more inhumane acts as part of that oppression. So maybe later in this interview, we could get into talking about the different elements and how they apply to Israel's treatment of Palestinians today. But just to say that that's kind of the definition of apartheid in a nutshell.
Where did the first acts of apartheid in the world take place?
Well, you know, certainly the word apartheid is an Afrikaans word. So it comes from South Africa. And certainly, as I was saying, you know, the world really associates the term with South Africa and, you know, the notorious system that existed there to disenfranchise Blacks and people of color. It's a little bit hard to say where the first acts of apartheid took place, because, you know, we've been seeing these kinds of inhumane acts carried out by one racial group over another, you know, whether it's been in the name of white supremacy or colonialism. We've seen these happening for hundreds of years. You know, I think it's interesting to trace the lineages and the linkages between apartheid in different places. So what we do know about South Africa is that even though that might have been the first country to start using the term apartheid, they actually based their system of disenfranchisement. So, you know, when they moved Black South Africans off of their land and started putting them into what they called Bantustans, which were these communities where Black South Africans were forced to live in. They were oftentimes slums, and people needed, you know, special permissions and passes from the apartheid government to enter and exit the Bantustans. Anyway, South Africa based that Bantustan system on Canada's reservation system. So they had studied how Canada had disenfranchised Indigenous peoples here and had forced Indigenous peoples off their land and into reserves and based their apartheid system on that. So again, I don't think we could accurately say, you know, where we first started seeing apartheid, but certainly the term first came about in South Africa.
How has apartheid been turned against Palestinians?
Well, in a plethora of different ways. I mean, this has been documented by Palestinians and by human rights organizations for many different years now. I think one thing that's really important to understand when we're talking about Israeli apartheid and how it impacts Palestinians or how it's been turned against Palestinians is that it's really fragmented the Palestinian population. So in general, we can kind of talk about this Palestinian fragmentation in three distinct places. So there's Palestinians who live in the occupied Palestinian territory. So this is commonly known as the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. So those are territories that Israel occupied in 1967, and they continue to militarily occupy those territories until today. It's the longest ongoing, modern military occupation. And, so Palestinians living in the occupied territory certainly face kind of their own set of challenges and crimes from the Israeli government. And then there's Palestinians who are citizens of Israel. So those are Palestinians who live in cities within what is known as Israel today. So that can be cities like Jaffa or Haifa or Acre in the north of Israel, Nazareth, and I could go on. These are Palestinians who they do have Israeli citizenship, but they're still legally disenfranchised in a lot of different ways. So whether that impacts, where they're allowed to buy and own land or who they can marry and bring to live with them in Israel, those are ways that those Palestinians are disenfranchised. And then there's, of course, Palestinians in the diaspora. So Palestinian refugees were forcibly displaced from their homes in 1948 and either internally displaced within Palestine or, driven completely outside the borders and today are forced to live all around the world. So whether it's in Lebanon, Jordan, or even here in Canada, those Palestinians are legally barred from returning to their homes that they were forced out of in Palestine, even though there is a right guaranteed under international law that any refugee who's forced to leave their home is allowed to return to their home. So those are just some of the ways that apartheid is kind of, let's say that it manifests itself against Palestinians. And it's just important to understand that really what it's amounted to is an incredible fragmentation of the Palestinian population.
Tell us about the Together Against Apartheid campaign.
Yeah, so this is a new national campaign that Independent Jewish Voices launched this week. We're really excited about it because we feel that we're at a turning point with regards to Israeli apartheid. Palestinians have been using this term apartheid to understand and to analyze their oppression for decades now. And the international community is slowly starting to wake up to that, to realize that apartheid is the accurate legal term to describe what is happening in Palestine today. So, you mentioned that Amnesty International published a report on Israel-Palestine at the beginning of February of this year, coming to the conclusion that Israel is practicing apartheid. They were the third major human rights organization to come to that conclusion in just the span of a year. More and more politicians from around the world are using that term apartheid, faith leaders, NGOs. And so we really feel that the time is right to create a broad-based understanding in Canada that, the word apartheid and, using apartheid with relation to Israel, it should no longer be taboo. There's no question that it isn't anti-Semitic. It's just simply a sober legal analysis to understand the situation. And so Together Against Apartheid, I think it's a campaign to educate Canadians about the realities of Israeli apartheid, but also to empower people to take action. right? So when apartheid existed in South Africa, there was this incredible movement of people from around the world who rose up and stood up in solidarity with the people of South Africa. And we're seeing that same thing today, Palestinians. So last spring, when Israel was bombing Gaza, we saw tens of thousands of Canadians from all walks of life coming out into the streets in support of the Palestinian people. And we feel that the time is right for there to be an understanding of Israeli apartheid and for people to stand up against it. And so part of this campaign is going to be encouraging people to set up apartheid-free zones in their communities. And an apartheid-free zone can be, it can be a grocery store, it can be a student union, it can be a shop, it can be a trade union, it can even be an entire city. And it's a space of proactive solidarity with the Palestinian people where there's a decision made within that space to either not sell Israeli products or to, you know, promote Palestinian human rights, to educate about Israeli apartheid. And so we're really excited about, you know, this possibility of apartheid-free zones, and we want to spread those across Canada.
What does the Amnesty International report say, and what is the call to action?
Yeah, well, it's a huge report. It's 280 pages, but some of the parts of that report are very digestible. So I would encourage your listeners, you know, to either go read the report if they have time, or to just even read, there's an executive summary that I think is about 20 pages. Amnesty has some great resources on their website. They have Amnesty Academy, where it's like kind of a 90-minute little online course where you can learn more about Israeli apartheid. But in general, Amnesty has gone to great lengths over many years to document all these different abuses and inhumane acts carried out by Israeli authorities against Palestinians. And so again, they look at a lot of different elements. First of all, they look at, you know, how apartheid impacts all the different fragmentations that I mentioned before of the Palestinian people. So Palestinians in the occupied territory, in Israel proper, and in the diaspora. And then what they do is they look at kind of, you know, different forms of disenfranchisement. So they look at home demolitions. They'll look at the distribution of water and electricity. They look at Israel's disregard for the rights of Palestinian refugees and the right of return. And, you know, what they've concluded is that all those things together amount to the crime of apartheid. And then there's, of course, calls to action in Amnesty's report. And some of those calls to action pertain to the Israeli authorities. So Amnesty is calling on them to end their practices of apartheid. You know, some of the calls are to the Palestinian Authority, to the International Criminal Court. Amnesty is asking that the International Criminal Court launch an investigation into Israeli apartheid. There's calls to action to the United Nations Security Council and to the General Assembly. But I think what's interesting for, you know, people listening to this interview in Montreal or possibly in other parts of Canada is that there's calls to action to states and to countries around the world, particularly countries like Canada that enjoy close diplomatic ties to Israel. And they're saying, Amnesty is saying that it's very important that countries like Canada not be complicit in the crime of apartheid, cut their support for apartheid, and, you know, make sure tangibly what this could mean would be cutting off weapons contracts. So making sure that countries like Canada aren't engaging in arms trade with Israel, which we are now, you know, making sure that countries like Canada aren't engaging in trade with illegal Israeli settlements, which unfortunately Canada does right now. So there's many different calls to action, and we're calling on the Canadian government to actually take this report seriously by, you know, refusing these human rights abuses and actually doing something to stop them.
How is Israeli Apartheid Week celebrated and observed?
So Israeli Apartheid Week is a fascinating initiative. It started in 2005, just by some students at the University of Toronto who wanted to get together and hold a series of events around Israeli apartheid. And that became an international movement over the years. So it happens on almost every single continent today. You know, you can find Israeli Apartheid Week events in Malaysia and Mexico and Kenya, in Israel, Palestine, in Canada, of course. You know, typically what happens is there's a central organization. So today it's organized through BDS National Committee in Palestine, but of course coordinated through different countries around the world. And then a week is chosen during the year. So here in North America, Israeli Apartheid Week is happening this week. So from March 21st to the 28th. It's interesting because it actually coincides with the International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, which is March 21st. And it's a real grassroots movement. So anyone can get involved. Anyone is invited and welcome to organize an event about Israeli apartheid and to include it into the global calendar of events. And if people want to find out more about it, they can visit the website. It's apartheidweek.org.
What has been happening to your blogger, Asher Kushner, in Palestine?
Yeah, so Asher is a member of IJV in Edmonton, and he's part of our national steering committee. He went on a delegation to Palestine, so he's there right now with the Center for Jewish Nonviolence. And that's a group that's been active in the South Hebron Hills. So that's in the south of the occupied West Bank. They've been supporting Palestinian villagers and farmers there for the last several years. We've been facing increased attacks, not only from, you know, the Israeli military, but also from really violent settlers who live in the region. And so it's been very important to have internationals, and you know, particularly Jewish internationals, go to document what's been happening there. Asher's been keeping a regular blog, which people can find if you just Google the Center for Jewish Nonviolence. You can find their blog and read about what's been happening in the South Hebron Hills.
If our listeners want more information on apartheid, the reports and campaigns, or on independent Jewish voices, where should they go?
Yeah, so I'd say the first place would be to check out our brand new website for the Together Against Apartheid campaign. It's togetheragainstapartheid.org, and there's a ton of information there about, you know, what is apartheid and how does it impact Palestinians and what can you do about it. You can also find the various reports on that website from Amnesty International, from Human Rights Watch, and from many different organizations. We're also asking people to sign a pledge against apartheid. You know, that pledge, we're hoping to gather thousands of signatures on it so that we can eventually bring it to the Canadian government as a sort of petition to say, you know, look, there's this critical mass of people in Canada who are rejecting Israeli apartheid. We want you to do the same. And so people can find that pledge again on that website, togetheragainstapartheid.org. And if people want more information about independent Jewish voices, you can find us at ijvcanada.org.
Well, thank you for your interview today.
Yeah, thank you, Sheila. It was great talking to you.
You have been listening to Aaron Lakoff speaking about apartheid and what independent Jewish voices is doing about it. I am your host, Sheila Ferrando. From March to June 2022, the Warhol Dervish String Quartet will play Beethoven Mystique, a series of five concerts dedicated to Beethoven's last string quartets, which will take place at La Chapelle Scène Contemporaine, while they share the stage with a very special guest artist. With us today, we have Pemi Paul of the Warhol Dervish String Quartet. Hi, Pemi Paul, and welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First, please introduce yourself and tell us how you came to be a musician.
My name is Pemi Paul. I'm the artistic director of Warhol Dervish. We are a chamber music collective, mostly string-based, playing out of Montreal. We're in Montreal. I began playing my journey with the violin and the viola when I was 3 years old. I began the violin, small kid, and I took lessons until, yeah, I don't know, for 20, 25 years, and have always been a musician as long as I know.
Which musicians are in the quartet, and what does everyone play or do?
The quartet is made up, for the concert that we're playing this week, of TJ Skinner and Chloe Chabanol on violins, myself on viola, and our cellist is Jean-Christophe Lizotte. They're all professional musicians in Montreal. They're all people who I work with and have worked with for a number of years. Some of them play with groups like the Montreal Symphony, I Musici, which are like Agora, or Agora Symphony in Montreal. Yeah, they're all quite successful freelancers and professionals in the city.
Tell us about the La Chapelle concert series and Beethoven Mystique.
Sure. We were offered this opportunity to do this concert series. Actually, they sort of gave us a bit of a, allowed me to propose something, and it has always been a dream of mine to perform a cycle of the last five quartets of Beethoven, which is what this cycle is. So they offered us five concerts, and I thought it would be perfect to do a cycle based around these final five string quartets by Beethoven, which were written in the last 7 years of his life. And they were pretty much the only music he composed in that time. There was a couple of late piano sonatas, and I believe he wrote the Choral Fantasy, which was like a major orchestral work in that period. But for the most part, he was very inactive. He was really busy with raising his nephew, which is a story of its own. And he had a lot of physical problems. And of course, he was completely deaf and isolated. And so this music comes out of like the deepest isolation, including the inability to hear any of the music that was going on around him. Like the only music that he was able to consume throughout the period of his deafness was what he saw, like the scores that he could purchase and look at. The series is called Beethoven Mystique. More to describe like that it's the mystical Beethoven. It's the Beethoven that sort of transcends the style that's sort of going on around him, like early romantic music or late classicism. And it transcends, kind of starts to transcend influence. And what I found really fascinating about this music is that some of it almost sounds like contemporary music, or at least that it's skipped over 80 or 100 years at least, and you don't hear music that kind of approaches it conceptually until well into the 20th century, but it's coming from the mind of this man who was writing this music in the early and mid 1820s. Yeah, and so that was sort of the main impetus behind the concert, was to be able to perform all five of the works. And there, most people who play chamber music would probably agree with me that they are considered like the absolute summit of, you know, the music that string players like me would ever have the privilege of playing.
What is the role of paper beat scissors in Beethoven Mystique?
So yeah, the other thing with this concert series was that we want to also somewhat, our group has always been about kind of, we're classical musicians, and we play notated music, and we play music from the European canon, but we're also really engaged with contemporary music and with music by our local community. And also we play a lot with musicians outside of the classical sphere, and we've always really tried to be a group that's not necessarily about being like a highbrow chamber music ensemble. And so over the years, we've collaborated with a number of friends and artists in Montreal who are also very successful performers and touring musicians, but who are more singer-songwriters or members of the pop community. And Montreal has a really fantastic pop music scene. So Paper Beat Scissors is the name of the band, the singer-songwriter whose the alter ego of Tim Crabtree. And I met him on tour with a band that I used to play with, a chamber pop band called Plumes, and we were touring around the East Coast. This would probably be 8 years ago, maybe. And we've stayed friends, and I think I've recorded on three or four of his albums now. And our quartets recorded with him. So we invited one of these friends of ours, people that we've recorded with or collaborated with or performed at Pop Montreal with, et cetera, to share the stage with us. So they would, after playing this like long, intense, sort of searching 1820s contemporary music, there's like a second half where we're joined by a guest artist and they play their songs and we join them for a few songs. And it's like a nod to a different aspect of collaboration and engagement with music that we have in our community.
May we listen to some of the music?
Yes, absolutely. Why don't we start with this? The first piece can be a motet. A motet is like a choral piece. This was written in the Renaissance by a composer named Carlos Gesualdo. It was originally for five voices. And we had it arranged for string quintet actually with a bassist, part of our collective. And it's sort of five individual voices that are all moving separately from each other. So you hear kind of like five interweaving voices. And I found that this is a kind of, gives you an idea, a little bit of one aspect of the language that Beethoven was accessing, you know, 500 years later, actually, while he was writing his late string quartets. So I thought that this might be a nice excerpt for us.
This is a motet by Carl Gesualdo on the Wednesday morning after.
Thank you.
What have you recorded in the past, and how did you arrive at the Beethoven Mystique series of concerts?
That's a good question. We have mainly worked as collaborators. So we've recorded several albums with Montreal's Josh Dolgan, known as So-Called, including two musicals. One was called The Season and one is called Tales of Odessa. We've recorded with Tim, Paper Beats Scissors. We've recorded with, who else have we recorded with? We've been working recently with Bastia Boulat. Over the years, we've collaborated a lot with a good friend of ours, Richard Reed Parry, who writes a series of music for heart and breath, where you play to the speed of your bow moves at the speed of your breath, and the notes go at the speed of your heartbeat, and you're playing with a stethoscope. And we've performed several festivals with him there. And we are planning actually our first album, which is going to be dedicated just to the quartet. And that will be planned for 2023. And it's going to be three string quartets by a Canadian composer named Tim Brady, who is another collaborator of ours. And he is the director of a new music ensemble in Montreal called Brady Works. So that's just a few things. There's a lot of other just collaborations with guest artists that we've worked with over the years, like Leova, who's a really incredible composer arranger from New York. And we've worked with Lucas Ligeti, who's the son of Georgi Ligeti, who's probably one of the most important composers of the 20th century, on some of his work, string quartets and also improvisations. Yeah, it's a really weird mixed grab bag of eclectic kind of work that we've managed to find ourselves over the years.
May we listen to some more of the music?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a string quartet. It's the second string quartet by Michael Osterley, and we will be hearing the first movement of that, at least an excerpt of it anyway. And it's based on the life of Alan Turing, who was important for being the one who solved the famous code cracker during the Second World War, and was a real hero and unsung hero in ending the Second World War, and was later persecuted by the British government because he was found to be homosexual. So this is the first movement of that work called Alan Turing by Michael Osterley, who's a Montreal composer who members of our quartet and me, including me, were members of his ensemble in the 2000s called Core Ensemble, which was a new music ensemble. And he's just an incredible, marvelous, wonderful Canadian composer that we're really lucky to have.
This is the first movement of the string quartet by Michael Osterley on CKUT.
Thank you. would cast a stone before you all the voice of fickle and unborn. At least you know all the things you know. Could there be anything that you would rather hear? Let's.
If our listeners want more information or to buy tickets, where should they go?
You can go to the Billetterie online at La Chapelle Scène Contemporaine. So the, let me see, the, so that's where you go. You go to the website of La Chapelle, Théâtre La Chapelle, and they have a Billetterie box office, and you can buy your tickets online there.
Thank you for your interview today.
Thank you very much, Sheila. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Pemi Paul speaking about Beethoven Mystique. I am your host, Sheila Ferrando. OSA is an electronic music trio born in 2018, composed of Anshi Sun, author, composer, and performer, Firas Nasri, multi-instrumentalist and producer, also member of the group Beja Kur, and Nadim Swade, bassist. With us today, we have Anshi of OSA, along with Firas Nasri and Nadim Swade. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us, yes.
First, please introduce yourselves and tell us how you came to be musicians.
My name is Firas, and I produce and compose most of the song for the band, and I also play guitar like. I believe I started playing music as a teenager when I bought my first acoustic guitar to do a Jean Leloup cover. I believe that's how it happened.
Nadim, what's your story?
My story, I started playing guitar. My cousin taught me like a few chords. This is basically how I started playing guitar. I wanted to be able to play my favorite songs. And then I played in many different bands, ranging from punk rock to indie to pop music. And then I met Firas because I was doing visuals for the band before. And I wanted to start playing bass because I was just interested in bass. I told Firas, so it would be cool to play bass in your project. And he went like, oh, I have something for you, maybe. And this is how I joined OSA as a bass player. I never played bass before, so.
And you, Anshi?
Okay, so for me, I'm the vocalist of the band, right? So I, as early as I can remember, I was singing basically, like as early, like 1 or 2 year old. So I was, I guess the interest and the raw talent was there from the very beginning. And both my parents are also like big music lovers. So I also grew up listening to the music, the cassette tapes, that shows my age, the cassette tapes my mom bought. And I remember we have like a whole wall of cassette tapes and then later CDs of music of different genres that my mom collected. And I guess that's my early education for music. But I never, because I never formally, like classically trained, study music growing up. So it's always just like a passion and just a talent. But a few years ago, before I moved to Montreal, I was still living in Vancouver. I started to teach myself how to write songs and just got addicted to it ever since. And the rest is history.
How and when did OSA form?
How did OSA form? Frost, do you want to talk about that?
Me and Anxi were briefly roommates a couple of summers ago. I believe we had a jam on the rooftop of the place where we were roommates a couple of years ago. I think one of our first jams, we jammed what later would become the single we are releasing this week, Not Too Far. Originally, it was like a old school house beat with like funky guitars on it. I still have the demos of that, I think, somewhere. And then later it became more like electronic pop. And then later we added like the funky bass line. And then the pandemic happened. And then the song just like stayed on my laptop for a couple of years. I think that's how the band formed.
You have a brand new single called Not Too Far. What is the story behind this song?
Oh, first, basically, just answer that question. Yeah. You know, I'll add something. So I remember really vividly that jam we had on the rooftop of the apartments we lived as roommates for. Actually, that was the summer I moved to Montreal from Vancouver. That's 2018. Me and Fras, we started to jam. Not Too Far is one of the things that we jammed. At that time, I had part of the melodies and part of the lyrics I written like when I was in Vancouver. But I think that jam we had on the rooftop of our apartment was when the ideas and the form really start to surface. And later we finished the song. So for us, produced the music of the song and I finalized the lyrics and the melody of the song. It is in Mandarin Chinese, which is my mother tongue. I'm Chinese Canadian. So the lyrics, I'll explain a little bit. It's called Not Too Far, Not Too Close, 不远不近. It's about the feeling you have when you first meet someone and it just feel like everything is so right, not too far, not too close. And I think I felt that way about Montreal when I first moved here. It's like especially the first month, the summer, golden summer month of Montreal, and everything feels new, everything feels different and fascinating. And this song also kind of conveys that feeling, like both about like somebody, but also about the city. So that's the story, the full story behind Not Too Far. And also, I think Faris didn't mention, like Nadim joined the band like a year or two after me and Faris met. He joins as a bass player, but he also do production and composition for the band too. Like we do it all together. Faris mostly producing, but the three of us also compose together, and Nadim also do some production. That adds another extra layer to the production of the song, the bass of Nadim.
As of this interview, you've just completed a concert. What happened that night?
Nadim, do you want to talk about it? You've been quiet.
I can talk about it. Well, that concert was held at Diving Bell, which is a cool venue on Saint-Laurent, Montreal. It was a really cool event, actually. We played all of our songs. The highlight was Not Too Far because it was the release show. What happened? Well, it was like... You know, people have been stripped out of this energy of going to live shows in Montreal that it feels like everybody wants to go out now and just like be in the vibe and reconnect with the local scene, with the local music scene. Yeah. So I really felt this way, like people were really happy to be here, really happy to go out. And even like outside of the concerts, there was a lot of people on the streets partying in different areas and places, and it really felt like electric. It was a really cool show, actually.
Yeah, the energy was like really amazing. That's only two nights ago. It really feels like a party, right? We call it a release party, and this really feel like people are like, yeah, finally we can party, like feel safe while partying together. Yeah, that was an amazing night.
May we hear some of your music?
Sure.
Yeah, of course.
This is Not Too Far on the Wednesday Morning After.
Me
Have a new EP coming up to be released later this year. What's the new EP called, and what can we expect from the album?
Maybe I should go. The new EP will be called Sunflower. I say it would have the same kind of electronic pop energy, very dancey songs, very pop songs, a lot of 80s influence, a lot of synthwave influences, a lot of cool instrumentals. A lot of great bass lines, a mix of English and Mandarin for the lyrics, a lot of catchy vocals, set to be released maybe later this year. We're still working on it. Sunflower.
All the songs are composed and we played like all the songs that we during our last show. It's just a matter of mixing and mastering and actually putting it out. So exactly. Shouldn't be too long.
Yeah. All the songs like four or five songs are at like different stage of completion, but it's, they are all like pretty close. And I just want to quickly add that the vibe of the song is very, like, for our music, it very, from the surface, it's very dancey and very, you know, high energy, very catchy. But it's also, if you really listen closely, it also very emotional, has a lot of depth to it. So we like to say that the OSA experience is the kind of experience where you find yourself dancing to the music, vibing to it, but also deeply moved. Yeah. So that's what you can expect from the EP.
May we hear some more of your music?
Sure.
This is Berlin in the Sand on CKUT. If our listeners want more information, some free listening time, or to buy your music, where should they go?
They can go to our Instagram or Facebook page. Our handle is OSA Music. So OSA spells O-S-S-A, OSA Music. And we have really cool music video just came out too. So you can go to YouTube to just search Not Too Far, OSA, and then you will get there. And the single is also out everywhere by the time you listen.